technological reason why it can't scale. Especially with social media, you need a much lower grade of censorship resistance than you do, for example, with a Swiss bank account. Swiss bank account, you know, if I'm Bitcoin, there's hundreds of billions of dollars worth of value in there. So it has to be locked super tight. Social media, okay, worst case, you hack it, you create some fake news. You know, you're going to have millions of dollars worth of security, not hundreds of billions of dollars of security. Much more tractable problem.
Now, if we get to a point where nobody has their thumb on the scale and the, you know, the regular news is sort of discounted, I've said that power will turn into the product of whoever, whether it's a person or an organization, that has the best product of influence, meaning skill to influence, knows how to do it, times reach, meaning size of audience. And I've speculated that if I reach a million users on Twitter, that I'm running the country.
Most credible man in the world. Yeah, certainly if you reach the right million. Well, every day that passes, it gets easier and faster to build your audience. You know, for example, a great tweet that I saw was that PewDiePie on his new news channel. This is a YouTube blogger who I've actually never listened to, so I'm talking secondhand now. But I think he's a kid out of Sweden or something like that, and he runs a very influential kind of a YouTube entertainment channel. But just his news broadcasts alone get three times the viewership of the number one and number two rated cable news shows. So PewDiePie is the most trusted name in news. So distribution is free. If you've got something interesting to say, distribution happens instantly. Like you and I could say something very insightful or controversial here. And if a billion people needed to hear it, you can bet a billion people would hear it. My How to Get Rich tweet storm on Twitter, by the way, across the whole set, it has about 40 to 50 million impressions. And that's just on Twitter. I'm not even counting the blog pages, the PDFs. I've not marketed one bit. I've never spent a dime on it. I haven't published a book, right? So when one random guy talking about how to make money can get 50 million impressions based just on the content, distribution is irrelevant. It's all about credibility. It's all about judgment. It's all about how much do people believe you and what you have to say. The message will get out.
Well, and the credibility is related to how influential you are, which is a set of tools. So
yeah, credibility comes from your ability to predict the future correctly and your track record for doing so, combined with your influence and your ability to convince people that you predicted the future correctly or can. It's a combination. It's a combination of influence and actual predictive power.
You might be amused, according to the audience here who is making comments, we started glitching like crazy on this last topic. So I'm not sure if it'll work on playback, but a number of people lost some of that. But
I could hear it just fine. So if you could hear me, hopefully it's stored somewhere.
But let me ask you some other questions. Universal basic income, is it inevitable because of the world of robots, or is it the worst idea ever, or something in between?
I think there is a form of universal basic income which works, which is free services. So, you know, do the thought experiment of if we all had degrees in hardware and software engineering, okay, and we were all perfectly knowledgeable engineers, what would the world look like 5 years from now? We would all be retired and our robot servants would be doing everything. Even our thinking would be done by electronic brains. We'd have unlimited entertainment from robot actors and virtual actors. We'd have unlimited food from robot farmers and so on. So technology can create massive abundance, and it's literally only just a lack of knowledge that holds us back. It's a lack of education. So I think we can get to a form of UBI where your cell phone is free, but it's not free because the government gives it to you. It's free because Google gives it to you, right? Because their robots want you to watch their virtual reality show that is accessible through their phone.
You're only going to get free stuff from a corporation if they think they can influence you to buy other stuff.
Point, I mean, you have to do something with your life. I don't think people just want free money, because if you just get free money, you have no meaning. Look at trust fund kids who never had to work a day in their life. What are they doing, right? They basically fly off the rails.
But wouldn't you say 10% of the population is going to be perfectly happy to stay on the couch?
They can, and they already do. I mean, what's the labor force participation rate, right? Not everybody works. And not everybody works full time. So that's fine. So, you know, some percentage of the population will always subsidize some other percentage of the population. The problem I have with UBI as a straight cash transfer is that is a straight slippery slide into socialism. And slippery slide is not a fallacy. That is actually just how humans work. So the moment you basically say, oh, you can vote yourself all the money you want, then first it starts with the 99% voting themselves all the money from the 1%, then 98 from 2, 97 from 3, and it ends when 51 at the bottom vote themselves all the money from the top 49, at which point you have a complete economic meltdown. So I understand that technology-driven leverage is exacerbating the gap between the haves and the have-nots. You were actually the one who said, what if it's not the rich are getting richer, but the smart are getting richer? This was something you said years ago that I thought was very intelligent. The problem is that if you just reallocate through pure force, violence, voting, there's just no bottom to that. You end up with Venezuela. So I think it's much better and safer for everybody if we do a combination of technology-enabled abundance, where, for example, education should be free at this point. The idea that you need to pay $500,000 to go to an Ivy League university and sacrifice 4 years of your life so the professor can lecture you in a lecture hall is absurd. You can already get all the MIT courseware online. You have things like Lambda School, where they'll literally pay you to go to school, or Y Combinator, where they'll pay you to start a company and while they train you. So it's just a matter of credentialing and the current economic and the current generation coming around to understand that. So these things will be too cheap to meter and almost free, and that will be the real universal basic income. By the way, nobody who has a degree in computer science, even if it's from an online school, is looking at the UBI as a potential outcome, right? Knowing how to manipulate computers and robots is the modern equivalent of reading, writing, and arithmetic. So what we're dealing with is we're dealing with the last generation that didn't know how to read at some point. And they're like, how are we going to make a living? We don't know how to read. And the economy is switching to a white-collar economy. So that's really what's going on. It's a one-time transition that needs to take place. This is not something we should wreck our economy forever around.
Let me challenge you on the slippery slope. You knew this was coming.
Sure.
So I've called the slippery slope an illusion, meaning that everything will go forever until there's a reason for it to stop. So
Right.
therefore, that explains basically everything. Everything will go until there's a reason to stop, but there's always a reason to stop.
Inertia, yeah.
And I would point out that since we already have many democracies, and in every democracy, the poor do have the power to vote themselves all the money, and it hasn't happened.
It hasn't happened because until now the US was a republic. And so republic slows things down. And for example, money and the elites had a lot more power in that situation. The US was designed as a republic, not as a direct democracy. The founding fathers feared mob rules just as much as they feared tyrants. But what's changed is now with the presidency having a lot more power. You know, as t television and media came along, the presidency was the most visible office, and so it just gained more and more power. And every time a Democrat or Republican was in power, they consolidated more power into executive actions and into the media bully pulpit of the presidency. For example, the presidency is not allowed to go to war. We're not supposed to be able to bomb anybody without congressional approval. Yet the president now can attack a country at any time. There used to be no such thing as an executive order. Now that's like a very commonplace thing. I think 200 years ago, if the president said, I'm not going to enforce that law because I don't feel like it, that would have caused a hue and cry. No longer the issue. The president couldn't talk to 100 million people by going on TV. Now, obviously, that happens. So we've become much more of a direct democracy because of those kinds of things, because of the consolidation of power in the presidency. And social media and crowdfunding and billionaires running for office have also turned it much more into a direct democracy. So I do think the republic aspect of the United States is breaking down to some extent. And that is leading more to a direct democracy, which will lead to, I believe, greater nationalism on the left and communism or socialism on the right. So I
Well,
think we're degenerating into a direct democracy.
but we're also completely changing who's in charge because it's who's influencing on social media, et cetera. So wouldn't it depend on whether the balance of influence on the internet is pro-socialism or anti-socialism?
Yeah, so this goes back to the people with the thumbs on the scale. The people writing the algorithms have an inordinate amount of power as to where everything ends up.
Yeah. All right. So I had thought that the future of education is going to turn into like a film model where like Hollywood forms a team that is together only for the purpose of making the movie and then they go on to other projects. And it seems to me that that's the way online education will go. So instead of the boring person standing in front of the classroom and you're just filming it as if you had never considered, you know, the differences in the online, you know, and the advantages you have, versus creating a product that has maybe a great presenter, or a great writer, or a great graphics group, a great editor. And there, it seems to me that if you were to compare online training to in-person now, in-person is either better or at least sort of similar. But long-term, would you agree that the online product, especially once you get to VR and everything else and ability to customize for every student, isn't it going to be 10x better than education is now?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the best teacher in the world for any given topic will teach everybody in the world about that topic. Like, you should probably be teaching everybody in the world about persuasion and influence. There's nobody better. So why would I go listen to number two when number one is available? My How to Get Rich Tweet Storm, you know, I'm actually turning that into a larger media piece that I'm going to give away for free. But once that's done, you know, you can learn from other people. Sure, you can add to your knowledge, but everyone should consume the best of any media. You can already see this happening with kids and YouTube, right? Kids are learning so much from YouTube. They're going on to YouTube. My younger cousins even told me that they would go to their high school and college classes, listen to the teacher, and then they go home and watch Khan Academy to actually learn the material. Like, that's literally how they were absorbing it properly. So we're still in the YouTube phase of this. Eventually, we get to the Netflix stage of this, where you will have exactly, you say, big budgets to create it. It's not going to be just video, though. You also need interactive elements. You'll need, you know, peer help. But you could imagine, here's something interesting about the internet. When the internet touches a business, it tends to go from a group of medium-sized competitors and producers who are separated by geography and regulation into being one or two or three gigantic aggregators and a huge long tail. So journalism will end up there. There'll be Twitter, Facebook, maybe the New York Times, maybe the Wall Street Journal, and a long tail of small journalists. All the ones in the middle will be gone. You see this in you see this across the board. You'll even see this in like media and music. You see YouTube and Netflix as the big aggregators, and you see a long tail. So the same way in teaching, you will see 2, 3, 4 gigantic schools which actually produce the content and produce the tests for the accreditation, and then you'll have a long tail of millions of tutors. So someone like you, for example, could be on Lambda School or their equivalent or YouTube, and you could be the influence expert as voted by the audience. You have the most votes, most views, you're making a living from everybody watching your videos, you have a team that helps you produce it, and then for actually on the street practice, there's a whole bunch of Scott Adams trained or certified devotees who basically will sign up with you and coach you one-on-one on Skype or whatever the equivalent is.
Somebody is asking what a long tail is. The best example of that is Amazon, instead of selling just the best sellers and the books that everybody wants, you know, back when they were mostly books, they could also cover a book that only sells 2 copies a year. So the long tail is all the little stuff that you could never buy economically before.
Yeah, and even beyond that, in the past, you had to publish a book, which was this giant chunky object, and now you have a long tail of blog posts that explain the same concept from 1,000 different facets. And then for each blog post, you have a long tail of tweets. So it's fractal. It just goes all the way down.
Right. All right. Here's my favorite question for you. And I love the fact that you didn't tell me what not to ask about, because what is the biggest illusion of life for average people? What illusions are they suffering under that are the most, let's say, the biggest obstacles to them having a better life?
I think the largest illusion is the illusion of meaning, that anything kind of matters. Because you're going to die. And the moment you die, like, this all goes away. So I think that's a big one. I think related to that is the illusion of free will, because you're here from it, you know, an unbroken chain of particle collisions from the Big Bang till now. So you're kind of just, it's your DNA reacting to your environment. So thinking there's a separate you making decisions is a hallucination. And then I think there's also just the illusion of reality, which is it's very high odds that we're statistically living in a sim, as you've talked about in the past, a simulation. And I think that one's even worse than people realize, because, you know, when people think, oh, we might be living in a simulation, they think of the Matrix, right? They think, oh, it's like the Matrix and, you know, we're like, I'm Keanu Reeves and I'm Neo and I'm trapped and there's like a real world above. Well, right. The thing is, if you understand simulation theory, it's statistically likely that not only is there one level above, there's zillions of levels above you. So in the Matrix, Neo doesn't actually get out. He just pops one level higher. And now he's even more deeply trapped because he's trapped in a shittier environment and he's convinced it's real, which is the ultimate trap. So now he's not even looking for the next level up. Even one level beyond that, it's worse than that, because statistically likely, if you're in a sim, you're not some real world character representing a sim. You're actually an NPC. There's, you know, millions more NPCs in Call of Duty than there are real players. So you're probably just a computer simulation. You are, and as the Buddhist would say, you know, you're kind of made of the stuff of the world, right? You're not separate from it. So I think there's a couple of illusions for you.
So I had a thought about the likelihood that we'll find intelligent aliens elsewhere on other planets. And I used to think the common scientific thinking, which is that the universe is so big that surely there are not just others, but probably lots of civilizations, because the statistics of it is so overwhelming, unless we're a simulation. Because if you're a simulation, you don't really have to write the world that nobody's going to visit.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is the rendering problem. Like if you look at a 3D graphics game, they don't bother rendering or creating any part of the world you're not looking at. And quantum mechanics hints at this, which basically says the observer affects the outcome. Without the observer, it's not clear anything is happening. This is a lesser well-known aspect of physics, but a very important one, which is the principle of least action. The principle of least action basically says that some energy, some unit is minimized in all of physics. Like basically, particles follow the most efficient path. The universe is maximally efficient. If you look at light, for example, as it travels through water versus air, light always takes the fastest, most efficient, most energy efficient path. So our universe is designed or just happens to be maximally efficient. So in a maximally efficient universe, you wouldn't bother creating or rendering things that you don't need. That's not to say that we may not have an alien encounter or two. It's still possible, and we may have already had. Who knows? It's just unknowable. But that said, like, the universe isn't going to bother creating and rendering lots of things when there's no observer there to see it.
Yeah, so the I've been collecting evidence that you would look for if you were a software product, in other words, a simulation. Like, what would you look for? And as you said, you'd conserve resources, so you don't render things that nobody's going to look at. But you would also make sure that people can't see what they're made of. And sure enough, in quantum physics, when you drill down to smaller and smaller and smaller, it just becomes something like probability, and it's only there if you see it.
That's right. It disappears. Yeah. But I mean, that has to be the case. So every formal system, including science or math, ultimately rests on belief. So in that sense, like, you can chase religion and math all the way down, and they have the same roots. There's only three ways to resolve the why question. Because you can always keep asking, well, why is it that way? Well, why is that that way? Well, why is that that way, right? And you keep drilling down. There's literally only three ways. Way number one is you have circular reasoning. Chicken or egg? Well, the egg came first. How did that come? Well, the chicken came before that. So that's obviously false logic, but circular reasoning. Right. A second is you can have it be axiomatic, right? Which is, well, we just take this belief to be true. And the third is infinite regression. Those are literally the only three ways that you can get to the bottom of anything. All three of them are sophistry. All three are loopholes. So at the end of the day, even math has axioms that you just have to take for granted. A simple axiom that we all take for granted is the world is going to behave the same way tomorrow that it did yesterday. The laws of physics are going to be exactly the same way. That's a belief. That's an unfalsifiable belief. So even science at the bottom of it is a belief, and nothing can be known for sure.
So I'm watching the comments go by, and people are just begging me to ask you if you're a Christian or you believe in God. This is a question you can take a pass on.
No, it's a good question. I think it's a very personal thing. I don't think anybody should believe in anybody else's rendition of God. To me, God is just a fancy word for existence. God is a fancy word for universe. You know, if there was a God, where would God stand? Right? Where would God sit? Where would God's home be? To me, it's obvious that God has to be the entire universe. The universe is God. It's just a definitional game. So, one set of people say God, another say universe. They're saying the same thing. So to me, existence itself is the thing. And we're made of it. We're subroutines in the greater reality.
Does that suggest that God is more perfect in our future because we're evolving and creating, ways to communicate, and we'll probably in your lifetime we'll be able to terraform planets and create life and all that. So would you say God is more in our future or more in our past under that filter on reality?
Well, I know your God's debris hypothesis, which is a remapping of the Buddhist hypothesis, that it's like, we got separated and we're under some kind of illusion. We're all trying to get back to one thing. And I think that's a reasonable hypothesis. I would just tweak it a little slightly, and I think it's all fine the way it is. I think existence just is. That's literally the only answer you can give. The definition of truth is what exists. The definition of perfection is what exists. There is no other definition. For example, if you have some prediction about the future and the universe turns out a different way the universe turned out is true and your prediction was false. So truth to me, by definition, is what actually exists. Most of the stuff that's going on in our head that are judgments saying this is right, this is wrong, this is the way it ought to be, those are false and those are illusions. So I don't think the universe is heading from imperfection to perfection. I think it's just all perfect the way it is. Just it may not be perfect according to my limited illusory false self's point of view. But that doesn't change that the thing is the way it is, right? Who am I to second guess? So in that sense, you could say I am spiritual. On the other hand, it's hard to keep all of this day-to-day in your head because we're biological creatures that are separated ourselves from the environment. We create a border around ourselves, and we try to take care of everything within that border to the detriment of everything outside of that border. And that's just how we got here. So of course, we're going to be always judging the external world as imperfect.
I have to rest every once in a while as my brain is processing. So somebody said here that God exists outside of our reality or something, and I'm thinking that I don't know what that means.
Yeah, well, that goes back to the trilemma that I talked about earlier. Well, then, okay, then who made that God, and where is that God standing, and why is that God that way? At some point, you either go to infinite regression, circular reasoning, or axiomatic, and the ultimate axiom is God. That's the axiom, which is, well, because God. At the end of the day, somebody got tired of answering the question why and just said, because God. That was the answer. It's just an axiom. So you can make that axiom whatever you want to yourself, but that doesn't mean there's an objective answer.
I have a proposal for the meaning of life. And, I always look for things that are sort of actionable and practical, nothing that's just a philosophy. And here's what I've noticed, that when people act in accordance with their biological nature, they feel satisfied and they have an interior sense of meaning. And when they're outside of their biological, evolutionary, channel, that's when they get anxious, that's when they think nothing matters, et cetera. So for example, you've gone from not having children to having a child. Did that add meaning to your life, or at least the sensation of meaning?
Yeah, absolutely it did.
And that's compatible with your evolutionary, biological sense. It feels like, I'm a believer that you can trace back most of our motivations to some evolutionary thing, at least if you use that model of the world. And that even things like being productive, doing work, learning, that these things are so tied back to your basic biological and evolutionary impulses that you will have the sensation of meaning when you're acting in a way that's compatible with your biological and evolutionary self. So
I absolutely agree. I mean, evolution is how we got here. And I don't see a lot of parents sitting around saying, what's the meaning of life? It's the kid that's running around right in front of them. Right. Yeah, if you can't explain something about human nature via evolution, you're probably doing it wrong. Human nature is all about evolution. I think where we get trapped, where we get screwed up, is when we're trying to solve society's demand, which is other monkeys, with our own demands, which is our biological programming. And I think a lot of the thing that creates unhappiness in modern society is a struggle between what society wants and what the individual wants. At least today, I think most people have this guilty voice in their head telling them what they ought to be doing. And that guilt is just society's voice talking in your head versus what you intrinsically want to be doing according to your biological programming. Now, the problem is modern society and modern civilization can hack your biology in many ways. We're not meant to consume infinite news, infinite porn, infinite food, right? We live in an era of too much abundance. Mm-hmm. So the modern struggle is almost, you have to be a modern ascetic to survive in society. You have to learn how to shield yourself from the incredible violence you can see on TV. You know, if you were evolving in a tribe thousands of years ago, if you saw one murder, it would have been so horrified and traumatic. The tribe may have talked about it for years and it would have taken you a long time to get over it. Now you can turn on the TV and flick through 50 murders, no problem, in a short period of time. What is the psychological damage that's done to you? The sugar that you're eating, the crazy porn that you've been watching, the drugs that you've been doing, the alcohol you've been drinking, all of that stuff is just throws us so far off balance that I think we're lost from our biological underpinnings. So, which is why when people need to recover, they go to an ashram, they go out in the woods, they go to nature, they go on a fast. If I can just, sorry to keep rambling, there's one idea I can introduce that I saw recently on YouTube. There's a great video about this. This guy had this idea for a dopamine fast, okay, which is for one day every couple of months, he goes on a complete dopamine fast, which means that he just drinks water. He doesn't really talk to other people. He doesn't read books. He doesn't watch TV. He doesn't go to work. You can meditate. You can exercise. You can journal, but that's it. And you can drink water. And so you reset your dopamine receptors back to where you can find meaning and happiness in the ordinary and everyday natural things.
Now, is that what he told his wife he was doing?
Right, when he actually ran off to God knows what.
All right. So define freedom. Somebody said on the internet recently that freedom was, you can measure your freedom by whether you have to get up on somebody else's schedule. If you have to wake up when somebody else wants you to wake up, you're not free. When we were negotiating to do this, you mentioned that you want to start at 11, our local time. Because you don't need to get up before that. And you're more of a night owl anyway, right? Don't you? You should.
Yeah, I went to bed at 3:30 in the morning last night.
3:30 in the morning?
Yeah.
So that feels like the definition of freedom to me. Oh, it looks like we lost Naval, and then he's back. And Naval, when you, you're going to have to, there you go, you're back. And we will be able to hear you in a moment. And he's back. You're there, right? Okay. So do you like that definition, that if you can wake up when you want to, you're free?
Yeah, I think that's a really good practical day-to-day definition. Not having phone calls you have to take, not having alarm clocks that you have to get up to. Not having to wear a tie. If you have to wear a tie when you go to work, you're not really free. If you have to be at your desk at a certain time, you're not really free. I think that's like physical freedom, right? Then I think there's also the freedom to make your choices in life, to kind of live the life that you want, to self-actualize. And then finally, there's freedom from your own thoughts, right? There's sort of that freedom from your own mind constantly telling you, berating you how you feel. So there's multiple layers to it. But I think as a practical everyday definition, I think not having to wake up to an alarm clock and not having to wear a uniform to work is a great one.
Now, I wanted to add something to the point before this. I got in trouble on the internet. It was actually the thing I was talking about earlier that BuzzFeed took a little too seriously. And I showed a graph of how the number of people living at home skyrocketed at about the same time as the first iPhone came out. And I said, just a coincidence. Now, I wasn't being too serious, But there is a part of that, and obviously it had more to do with home prices and the economy. So that was, assuming that's the major driver. But here's the thing. If I had a smartphone, I would have a lot of entertainment and a lot of access to things that give me dopamine without leaving home. You know, if I had a bedroom and mom's cooking, I could probably be okay with that for a long time. Whereas I remember my own motivations to get out of the house as soon as possible were because there was nothing in the house that I ever wanted to do. Like being in that house was just so unhappy, you know, just bored and, you know, et cetera. But if I had a smartphone, I might not be in such a hurry because it satisfies so many of my social and, you know, intellectual needs. Do you think there's anything to that?
Oh, yeah. The real universal basic income is cannabis and video games.
That is the best thing you've said in 5 minutes because you say a lot of it. the real universal income is cannabis and video games.
Yeah, that's watch not that wrong. Get it tweeted and quoted. Obviously, it's tongue-in-cheek, but yeah. I mean, this is the modern struggle. There is so much of an abundance of sort of cheap, fake, instant dopamine and meaning. Like, how do you motivate yourself to do the real thing anymore? This is the thing that every parent is currently struggling with. This is the thing that every teenager is currently struggling with. And I think the next generation is going to have to learn how to conquer a greater set of addictions. Like you know, all the problems of olden times were scarcity. I don't have enough of whatever. Now they're all abundance. I have too much of this. I have too much of that. How do I stop doing this? How do I stop eating? How do I stop playing video games? How do I stop drinking alcohol? How do I stop smoking weed? How do I stop going on social media?
Well, not the bottom 20%. They still have a shortage, but the point stands. Yes.
Well, I think that's right. But I think the at least in a first world society, success and failure in the future and even today is much more about how you control and manage and break addictions than it is about even going out and doing something.
Wow. That now I completely agree with that. And I've never heard anybody say it before. And I wonder if we'll get to the point where your DNA will predict what kind of an addictive personality you have. Are we already there?
We're already there. And in fact, if you look in human history, generally pessimists survive because if you're walking through the woods with a friend, you hear a tiger and the pessimist runs, the optimist thinks it's not a tiger, the optimist gets eaten, right? So historically, pessimists survive and optimists don't make it. But I think in modern society, because we have so many options available to us, optimists do a lot better. Optimists, you know, break up and go find a new girlfriend or boyfriend because there's just many more people to select from. Optimists do well because there actually isn't a tiger in there. It's an opportunity. So optimists do better in modern society. But I think the new transition that's happening is that people who have the DNA to resist addictions will do better. That being said, like, I'll be honest, I have an addictive personality, which I have to be very careful about. But it's the flip side of another coin. The flip side is I also have an obsessive personality. So when I learn about something new, I dive into it and I become an expert on it because I can't stop reading about it. I can't stop thinking about it. When I have a problem, I get obsessed and I just solve it. So addiction may also be related to just this ability to focus on something and get lost in something. It's not clear to me that you can have one without the other.
I totally agree with that. Now, I heard an interesting idea. I won't say where because I don't want to spoil it by saying where it came from. And the idea was that since you can check the DNA of somebody to find out that they have addiction, I'm remembering now I heard this before. Suppose you had a law that says if you give a drug, let's say an illegal drug like fentanyl, cocaine or something, to somebody who you know has that DNA, and let's say there's some way to know that, you know, it's mm-hmm. published. Just imagine there's some way to know that if you give somebody a drug to somebody who does not have an addictive personality, well, then you're just a drug dealer. But if you give a drug to someone who does have an addictive personality and it can be knowable, whether you look for it or not, but let's just say it can be knowable, that you get the death penalty because you basically killed somebody.
Yeah, I mean, it does sound a little extreme, but I think you're onto something there, which is that, like, if I go to Vegas, you know, 90% of people don't have a gambling problem. They're kind of just passing through using it for entertainment. But there's a small percentage of people who are stuck to the slot machines, and they should never have been allowed in the first place. Right. And it would be good to know who those people are in advance so we can educate them. I'm not sure we need to give the death penalty to someone who screws it up, because, you know, human nature being human nature, people will find their way to addictions. But the better is just the defense, you being armed. What if you knew what your addictions were, so you knew to watch out for them, and your family knew to watch out for them, and you just kind of new to stay out of those situations. I've never had a drug addiction, so it's hard for me to kind of empathize on or to fully understand that. I understand you had a loss in the family, which is very tragic around it. But I'm not sure, like, throwing around the death penalty is the answer.
It makes me feel good, though, because for the reasons you mentioned.
But I agree that there's absolutely something about gene sequencing, DNA origins of these things to just understand what you're vulnerable to.
All right, I've got a dangerous question, and again, you have the right to pass on this.
Yeah, by the way, this entire conversation is probably going to get me deplatformed out of my life. Just so aware of this.
It's my dog growling or something. All right, I'm seeing in a number of different contexts the conversation about who's responsible for what. And so let me give you some examples. When Trayvon Martin... I think that's the right name, got shot, he was wearing a hoodie, and then people said, well, if he wasn't dressing like that, you know, there wouldn't have been any problem. And of course, we saw today there was one of the judges who's being considered for one of the lower courts had said sometime in the past that women maybe should not drink so much because it contributes to maybe sexual assault. And people said, no, that's, you know, the responsibility is the perpetrator, not the victim, of course. Now, every time I see people talking about stuff like this, and also the MAGA hat, if you wear the hat, you're sort of asking for it. No, it's really just the person who does the attacking. But why can't people separate what is responsibility, both socially and legally? Because that's pretty clear. Like the people, whoever does the attacking is legally and socially responsible, period. But why can't we talk about risk management? Certainly there are things that people do that put them in more risk or lesser risk, independent of whose responsibility is to avoid the trouble. Why can't we get that right? You know, do you have any insight on that?
Yeah, I don't really, I honestly haven't paid attention to most of the things that you just talked about, because to me, these are just in the domain of politics. And politics is just the exercise of power without merit. So there's no, you can't put reasons underneath anything political. It's really people just make up their minds on who they hate and who they like, and then they'll just justify anything. So there's contradictions all around. You know, one side will do something and then turn around and the other side will do it, and there'll be accusations of hypocrisy, but they never stick. Because as you say, everyone's living in their own movie. This is not based on reason. There's no reality underneath. In real life, you do risk management all day long, right? Like if I'm walking down the street, I'm not, you know, and if it's in an urban neighborhood, inner city, I grew up in Jamaica, Queens, which is a really rough neighborhood. I would not walk around flashing a wad of 20s. And then when the guy attacks me, I say, it's my fault, you know, it's your fault. Of course, it's his fault. At the end of the day, everyone's responsible for their actions. But I definitely put myself in a difficult situation by flashing around a wad of 20s. It's just common sense. But you're right. We can't talk about common sense because we're now in the domain of politics where sense making doesn't apply.
You're correct. I think we don't want to go too long because it'll make it harder for people to look at it. So we should wrap up. Is there anything you either wanted to ask me or anything you wanted to add?
Yeah, I actually think that, you know, instead of, I'm waiting for you to write the book on hypnosis, you know, of all kinds, on not just persuasion, but just sort of next level hypnosis.
That's what Win Bigley was.
Yeah, but I'm talking about like getting very systematic, especially at certain, let's just be clear. I've seen your girlfriend. You've got a book to write just based on that. So that would be
it. Could be my charm. All right. Well, yeah. Maybe it will. Now, people have suggested, and I always think of you when this topic comes up, that people who have read a lot and have a good sense of what would be good to read should have their list. I think you do have a list somewhere.
I don't actually have an official list because I've just read so much. It's hard for me to even pick top 20 books, let alone, you know, top 10. Even top 50 is hard for me. But I also, my interests wander. I think one of the problems is that the book that appeals to you at a certain point in time, you know, is not a book that appeals to you 5 years later or 5 years earlier. So a lot of it is about the reader to the author fit. But I think like there are some timeless ones like in science fiction. I don't know if you're like Jorge Luis Borges, Ted Chiang, Snow Crash, Neal Stephenson, on sort of science writing. Matt Ridley has written some amazing books, Genome, The Red Queen, Origins of Virtue, The Rational Optimist, The Evolution of Everything. I like, you all know of Harari's Sapiens, which I've recommended before. It was an amazing book. Will Durant's The Lessons of History. I do read a lot of philosophy. And I've basically read everything, but I like Siddhartha, simple Hermann Hesse kind of novel, which is partially or mostly fictional, but still really interesting. Seneca, you know, the Stoics. I like science. Carlo Rovelli is kind of a good modern physicist who writes some good stuff. But, you know, I also recommend reading all the originals, you know, read The Eighth Day of Creation, read The Origin of the Species, read The Wealth of Nations. There's no need to, you know, what people do today is someone writes a book on evolution, which is interpreting Darwin for you. And then somebody else updates it slightly and writes the blog post. And then there's the clickbait BuzzFeed version. And then there's the hot take tweet on it. And people are reading the hot take tweet on when they could just go read The Wealth of Nations, right? You don't have to read an interpretation of an interpretation of an interpretation of an interpretation. And especially when you're building your foundational knowledge, it's really important to read the basics and the originals.
Well, although the caveat there is that evolution, as your example, has changed quite a bit. So the original theory has been tweaked a number of times.
It's still basically correct. And, you know, and Darwin didn't have the political agenda that a lot of people who are tweaking it today do.
Yeah, that's true.
Start with Darwin. You can add the tweaks later. But if you don't understand the basics and you're just memorizing advanced concepts, you're completely lost. It's far more important in life, as you have pointed out, to know the basics really well across a few domains and combine that than to try and be a deep expert in any one domain. The simplest analogy I have to this is mathematics. Everybody at some point in their life sat down to math class and there was a day when they no longer understood the basics of what the teacher was talking about. And at that point, math turned to memorization, whereas up until then it was logic. So the moment math turned from logic to memorization, you lost the ability to do and learn mathematics beyond that point. So I would argue that, you know, you should always build in a very solid foundation of understanding. And at any point you're reduced to memorization or reading other people's opinions and taking those as your own, that you need to stop and backtrack.
All right. I like that. I like that advice. Let's wrap it up here. And to the audience, thank you for hanging in here.
Thanks, everyone.
And Naval, feel free to have me on your Periscopes one of these days.
Anything? Yeah, I absolutely will. I wanted to try out this call-in feature. This was great. I want to do more Periscopes. I'm actually on the hook for it because I promised the Twitter team if they roll this feature out, I would be using it. So here I am. Right. And I'm going to be doing more regular Periscopes with guests. You know, honestly, the hard thing for me here is that, you know, we live in a very intolerant environment, clickbait news, where people want to take everything out of context and sort of attack people. But I think I just have to get used to that. It's hard to say anything interesting without annoying somebody out there. And I guess people's feelings are their problem, not my problem.
Exactly. All right. So thank you very much. And we'll wrap it up.
Thanks for having me on, Scott.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.